I'm your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to Alchemy, the podcast all about building a business on the front lines of the new economy.
Welcome back to this week's episode of Alchemy. Very excited. We've got lots of great things coming out with 420, and we've got Jigar Patel. He's the co-founder and co-chief executive officer for NorCal Cannabis. Jigar, it's great to have you on the show. I know we've been trying to get you on for a while now, so I'm glad we were able to do this.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me. And obviously in cannabis, we kind of live day to day, so actually getting to spend some time
for sure
talking with you is going to be some fun.
We'll have a good time today. And so, you know, for all the folks that are tuning in right now, NorCal Cannabis is, you know, one of the largest operators in California. And number one seller of indoor flower. They've got a ton of brands. Jigar, you've been in the industry now for a long time. I think you're probably one of the longest folks in the industry. I think you're something like, what, 20 years now in cannabis?
Yeah. I mean, 20 plus years on all sides of it. So
I mean, that's a long time. Most people like, you know, 5 years, even the top 10 years, but that's incredible. And so I'm super pumped to talk to you today because you do lots of things in the space, but also you have a wine business as well. And so I definitely want to talk to you about that. The California market we've been hearing about for a long time, the great things, the bad things, lots of things going on in California right now. And why don't we kind of kick things off? Tell us a little bit about NorCal. Tell us about the story. I know you've really helped that company grow from just a few million dollars in revenue to, you know, over 70 million in just 3 years. So I know a lot of companies have really tried to survive and they haven't been able to. So talk to us about some of the survival skills that you guys have done and all the great things that you guys have been able to come out with.
Well, how much time do we have?
We got 20 minutes.
I'll give you a brief rundown about NorCal and I guess how we kind of position ourselves and who we are. This company really wasn't made in a boardroom. What you do have here is a lot of folks that have been in the cannabis industry from the early days of Prop 215 and also from all over the country prior to that, that had a real passion for cannabis. My story really was a passion for cannabis at a young age, pointed me in the direction of California and Prop 215, followed some friends out here in the early 2000s, and really jumped in with 2 feet. You know, I'd been a cannabis guy. You know, it changed my life at an early age, opened me up to a world that I didn't really see, being, you know, an immigrant kid from, you know, just a hardworking immigrant family. I think that if you look back then, my parents never would have thought that I'd be running a cannabis company. I think.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Toronto, grew up in Chicago. You know, so between Chicago and my time at Purdue is really where I got a lot of my chops. And, you know, it was those days at Purdue, meeting some folks that were in the cannabis industry and actually headed out to participate in Prop 215 is really what led me here. You know, when I got to California, you know, I was really amazed at really just the underground culture. I knew it existed. You know, if you'd been reading High Times, all of that stuff that you've been reading for years was actually happening here north of San Francisco. And, you know, Sonoma at the time was the best place to actually kind of lay that foundation. It was the safest place for indoor cultivation under Prop 215. So, you know, I picked up everything I had, moved to California, and really kind of jumped into it. Had some background in, you know, minor cultivation, but, you know, here you had this plethora of folks doing it and, you know, got in the right circles, you know, learned more about how Prop 215 functioned, the caregiver method, and just the framework, the regulatory framework that allowed it to exist. You know, and in doing so, picked up a lot of folks that wanted to work with us. And we built a pretty strong model back then. So we had multiple collectives that were serving, you know, many of the biggest and oldest dispensaries in the state. Mm-hmm. Through that, we looked at a lot of different ways to really legalize cultivation in a way that wasn't just protecting us from the law, but also allowing us to be a real business with real enterprise value. And in, you know, early 2014 and 15, we were able to convince the city of San Francisco to allow us to actually tie a permitted cultivation onto a back then a medical cannabis dispensary. And by doing so, it allowed us to actually build what was like the first really permitted cultivations in the state of California. And so at one point, you know, there was about 21 of those in the city of San Francisco, and, you know, affiliates of what is today NorCal or partners or founders of NorCal, you know, almost had half of those. So we were pretty early to the space. You know, at that time is when I actually found out the two co-founders, Blair Carter and Doug Cortina, who were doing a very similar thing to me in the city of San Francisco, which was permitting a warehouse cultivation. And that really was the beginnings of NorCal. And in doing so, you know, we kind of set out to go raise money as a collective group, and went from basically going all in with our own money to what you see today, which is folks that have raised money on the back of kind of large organizations. So at that time, we had put together all of our collective entities into a holding company, which is now NorCal. You know, and there's been a lot of variations to what NorCal has been, like a lot of companies in California, not really sure how legalization would play out. You know, we always had a focus on brand, and at that time we thought delivery was our answer. So we set out to be the largest vertically integrated delivery player in the state, and we accomplished that. But what we learned along the way was, well, that was great for revenue and building a direct-to-consumer relationship. If the capital dollars weren't there, it really didn't make sense as a business. The regulatory structure of cannabis in California is burdensome by many factors, or because of many factors. But the delivery one, and when you consider 280, it makes it really impossible to do that at scale. So, you know, along the way, we looked at what we were doing and realized that while we're great at delivery, you know, without access to hundreds of millions of dollars, it was basically a failed attempt. And so we had to make a strong pivot. And luckily, we kind of fell back on our roots, which were cultivation. And, you know, that really is who NorCal is today. We consider ourselves one of the most efficient indoor operators, not only in the state of California, but also the world. And it's on that that we're allowed to really push our brands and give consumers and customers what they want. And when I say consumers and customers, I think, you know, people need to understand that those are two different things today in cannabis.
A couple of questions for you as far as California is concerned. Well, first and foremost, you guys are in California proper. Are you out of the state at all, or is it just home to California?
No, I mean, you know, we've always believed that this was the most important state, and you really had to plant your flag here. And those that were able to actually produce their or plant their flag, but also, you know, show real growth in a really competitive market. And what we think is the most competitive market in the world will have plenty of opportunities elsewhere. And we're seeing that today. We get a lot of inbound calls, not just for brands, but also for us coming and running people's operations in other states. I think, you know, as other states begin to see, you know, price drops and more competition, a lot of this is going to start looking a lot more like California and Colorado and Oregon. And, you know, as these moats disappear, operators are going to be the ones that are going to be the next wave of cannabis 2.0.
Yeah. So I'm in New York, and, you know, I'm sure you've been following everything. And finally, New York is legal. And, you know, we have seen the first few social equity licenses kind of go into business and open up in the city. There is a crazy amount of, you know, black market illicit products out there, especially here in New York, because, you know, no one really understands. It's not like us where we're in the industry and we see what's happening in California and Colorado and Washington and, you know, have been in the industry for a while. New York, no one knows what's going on. And so people in New York actually feel they say, oh, it's legal now. So they think they could go into a head shop and they get illicit market products that are, they think it's legal. They don't know. They don't know the brands. And they're, it's just because they just don't have the knowledge. California obviously has been around from the very beginning, obviously the first state to really, you know, have recreational cannabis. What's going on there now with the black market? Because I know they cannot control it in New York at the moment. There's so much of it. And they're kind of, you know, I think they're waiting to kind of bust these guys. But I know for a while I was reading all these articles for years about the black market. Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse?
I mean, it, you know, And it's really difficult to like quantify that, but I guess if you just look at the black market, it's no longer just California, right? Mm-hmm. I think for years people assumed that California fed most of the country, and it did. But you know, with a lot of these states that have what I would call quasi legalization, basically legal structures that allow lots of backdooring, what right. you've seen, you know, is the protections of being able to grow, but then people moving product to other states. And I think California has clamped down quite a bit on that in terms of legal operators. Now, the illegal operators, I think that there's definitely been a trend downward. What you see today is a lot less smaller mom and pop illegal operators in California. I think you see a lot less illegal shops in California, minus call it LA, which right. is significant because it is the biggest market, not only in California, but the world. You know, the LA metropolitan area, even compared to New York, probably consumes more cannabis than anywhere else on earth. But that being said, like, you know, I think the illegal stuff doesn't affect the California retail as much as it affects wholesale prices throughout the state and then throughout the country. And what you're seeing in New York is a proliferation, not just of California, but of Oregon, California, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. Michigan, anywhere where there's the ability to get product out of the legal channels and moved, you are seeing people take advantage of it because you have a perishable good that they put a lot of money into. And if they didn't really think about it and don't have the sales channels, like, they need to recoup that cash. So, you know, while this was something that was been done for years, I think those that are operating in the legal market today are playing for a different game, right? I think, you know, when you look at us at NorCal, we're playing for enterprise value. We're playing for, you know, building a brand that has meaningful brand equity long term, and you know, we're playing to return value to all of our shareholders and employees.
No, I'm interested to talk to you a little bit more about your wine business, but I'm also very interested to hear your perspective because, you know, Fila, we work with so many brands, not just in cannabis, but traditional brands. And we work with a lot of beer, wine, alcohol companies. And what they're experiencing is that they're starting to play a lot of defense because for the first time, they've been seeing people literally defect from, you know, their drinking habits and behaviors to now consuming more cannabis related products, whether it's edibles, whether it's pre-rolls, whether it's vapes, and even beverages now. And so it would be very, very cool to hear your perspective because, you know, being on both sides of it, right? Like having your own winery and then also running a cannabis brand, they kind of also go hand in hand together. But I've been seeing all this stuff lately about California Sober, right? Where people are, they're consuming cannabis and psychedelics, but they're not drinking. Any insight or things that you might be hearing or even just being in the wine business at all, any experience that you've heard of, you know, what's happening in the West?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's funny, right? Just like anything else, everything kind of has trends and is cyclical. You know, we've seen that in cannabis, we've seen it in alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I think that there's a turn towards what we call Cali sober and people really more interested in psychedelics and cannabis because the notion that it's just not as harmful to your body. That being said, I mean, I think over COVID, we've seen some pretty large spikes in alcohol consumption as well as cannabis consumption. But, you know, yeah. There was a big movement for alcohol consumption in the early days of the pandemic. You know, when you look at alcohol, look, it's been around like cannabis forever, but just more acceptable, you know, both legally and socially in circles for centuries, right? So, you know, while cannabis has also been around, it just really hasn't been, I would say, at the forefront like as alcohol. But, you know, as a consumer of both, I think that, you know, alcohol, it's different than cannabis, obviously. And, you know, and being from the wine industry, and look, I was a cannabis guy that had always enjoyed wine, but living in Northern California was turned on to it just because of the similarities in production and terroir and just the different varietals. There definitely is a lot of similarities between winemaking and cannabis production that I see. And again, I'm really kind of, you know, I'd say my hands are dirty in both in terms of like understanding the process, you know, all the way through. But that being said, like when I look at it from a consumer perspective, I think that, you know, people are more concerned about their bodies. The more and more data they have really leads them to believe that excess, you know, I would say alcohol consumption is not good for you. And there are other ways to achieve some of the things that people are looking for in alcohol with cannabis and or psychedelics. And so I think that there's still going to be a mix. I don't think you're ever going to see any of these things leave. I just think what you're seeing is really cannabis having its day. That's really been suppressed for no other reason than paranoia and really control. So, you know, I think we're having our moment, and look, we're excited about it, but I think that I don't think it's a full replacement for anything. Does that make sense?
Totally. All right, let's switch gears a little bit. You guys have been building this pretty amazing flagship brand, Lolo. So looks like best-selling brand in the state of California. You've got 420 coming up. Tell us the difference. I mean, I've looked at the packaging. It looks very cool, very clean. You know, give us a little bit of insight into the development of it, how people are reacting to it.
Yeah, no, look, I think, you know, one of the things that we did early on when we started NorCal was we brought in a business intelligence unit, actually later became Pistol Data, but we basically did a first pass at a survey here in a white paper in California, and the data, all the data led us back to, you know, the what we call the OG smoker and what their preference was, and what that data told us was that smoker really didn't recognize brand yet, that they believed brand was more hype than anything else, and what they were looking for was quality, consistency at a good price. It was almost like they could see through the bullshit, right? And, you know, we kind of looked at what we were doing and realized that we had, you know, enough product. And if we graded this all correctly, we could, you know, have kind of our house of brands, which was good, better, best. You know, and Lolo really was a representation of good. What we're able to do with Lolo and why we're able to do it really goes back to, you know, who we are as cultivators and our ability to be more efficient than the rest. And so, through that efficiency, we're able to consistently produce quality product at a better price, which allows the consumer the ability to buy more of it. And, you know, this is important to think about because a lot of people think about, you know, cannabis as just being new. Well, those of us that have been in this game for decades understood that while the hype strains were always wanted, there was a limit to how much anybody would ever take. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I was going into a dispensary in the old days and let's say purple was the strain of the year, nobody was buying 30 pounds of purple. They would say, bring me 5 pounds of purple this month, but I need 25 pounds of really good stuff at the right price. Like, if you were able to fulfill that, you were the winning cultivator. And that's carried on through this. And really, it just speaks to the California consumer, but also the customer being the retailers and the buyers that are buying it from us, right? We have to give them a product they can make money on. And conversely, they have to give the consumer a product that the consumer can rely on and also feel good about purchasing. And I think what we've achieved with Lolo is that unique ability to not only make sure our customers are happy, but that to see that carry through the consumer, right? Because if we give the customers what they want, but they triple the cost of that and don't pass it on to the consumer, well, then the consumer doesn't see any difference in that. And so what we've been able to do is really pass that on to the consumer. And I think what makes us special is our ability to consistently do that. You know, Lolo's growth over the last year has been pretty phenomenal. That's over 100%, right? And again, we don't have a big marketing budget for it. We really rely on the fact that, you know, we want to get quality product into the hands of the best buyers and retailers in the state. Tell them that here's a product you can make money on, and the volume that you can do with the power consumer will show it. And, you know, our sales reps go into stores and they don't really have to fight for much other than say, hey, give us a shot. And, you know, there's a reason every major chain in the state carries Lolo.
We're running out of time, but I want to make sure we get to some questions about you. We've been doing the show now for a few years and we're kind of approaching near our 200th episode. But for the most part, we've always done some really fun questions at the end. And these are just kind of quick fire. First thing that comes to your head. Are you ready?
I guess.
Okay. So first question, what's the craziest thing you've ever done?
Jesus, that I can talk about?
Sure.
I guess I'm talking about it right now. I mean,
we have an explicit rating on the show for a reason. So
whatever you want. I mean, look, it's just pretty crazy to see that a kid that, you know, was scared about smoking weed, you know, produces, you know, multiple tons of indoor cannabis a year. Like, again, like sometimes I have to sit back and, you know, even though that this is real to us, like if you imagine where we've come from and what we do today, like that's crazy. I mean, here's crazy. I wrote a check to Kamala Harris for district attorney, and she's now the vice president. And this was based on cannabis, probably, you know, 15 years ago.
Pretty amazing. Favorite childhood TV show or even a movie?
Different Strokes. That dates me. Movie The Godfather.
Different Strokes. My God, I haven't heard that in a long time. What was it? What'd you say, Willis?
What you talking about?
What you talking about? Okay, so if you were in a deserted island, you could only bring three things. What would you bring?
I mean, by things, are we talking humans? Because it'd be my wife and kids.
It could be humans. It could be things. You're going to bring your wife and your kids.
My wife and my kids. But, it, you know, if it, it was outside of humans, it would probably be I'd say a cannabis seed, a knife. God. You're putting me in survival instinct here.
Oh, by the way, water. Cannabis seeds and a knife. I kind of think I know what you're going to say next, because it would be a natural thing to bring if you're bringing cannabis too.
What, papers?
No. You could use like palm leaves or something. How are you going to burn it?
Oh, I mean, we'd go the you know, flint. We'd find something on the island to start the fire. That I'd go back to my Boy Scout training for.
Okay, good. You could make a fire without cannabis. You're good. Okay, last question, easy one. What's your favorite type of food?
You know, that's so funny because I enjoy all kinds of food. But really, my heart is set on Chicago Italian beefs. Like, I am a Chicago fast food, Italian beefs, Chicago-style hot dogs. Like, and I know that sounds crazy because I've eaten at some of the best restaurants around the world, but my heart is back into that American food I grew up eating in Chicago.
Love it. I'm in Chicago next week, so email me anytime.
Oh, man, make sure you get an Italian beef with hot jardiniere and a Chicago dog the right way, and you won't.
All right, I'm going to have to do that. Well, Jagger, listen, it was great to have you on, and, you know, congrats on all your success and, you know, all the great things that you guys are doing and the new brands, and, you know, I hope that you guys have also a bang out 420 this year.
Yeah, let's hope so. You know, I think the one thing that folks that have been in the cannabis industry can be kind of confident in is we've seen recessions, which really are good for cannabis. And so, you know, while it's kind of bleak out there, we're hopeful that things turn around in the cannabis industry and we get to see this thing through. Yeah.
I think it's time. I mean, I think going into Q2, like, things are definitely, you know, looking better. I think Q4 and Q1 was, you know, it's tough on everyone, not just cannabis. I think the entire world. So things are looking up. Let's hope. Crossing our fingers. Jigar Patel, thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for the conversation. Appreciate it.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.